The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. U.S. has dropped the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan. Cost $315 million per bomb. This wasn't really about Afghanistan. They're talking today about how, you know, it collapsed the tunnels and everything else for ISIS, but this wasn't about Afghanistan. This was a show of force to North Korea. North Korea supposedly is going to do another missile test this weekend. It's their big celebration, their big anniversary. This was to show force and what we can do to things underground, I believe, at least. Also, the U.S. Air Force was conducting a massive surprise exercise, another warning to North Korea yesterday. Who is the president of the United States? I thought this was a guy who was like, oh, we're not going to get involved in all of these things. Has he been co-opted, to use maybe perhaps the wrong term? Who is this guy? Also today, we're going to talk again to Jack Barsky. We've done this once before with Marcus Luttrell. Marcus Luttrell, when he first came back from Afghanistan, he was on the show and he started telling me the story, which turned out to be the lone survivor. And I said to him, will you come back tomorrow and talk to us some more? Only time we've ever invited a guest back the next day. Did it yesterday to Jack Barsky. He spent an hour with us. He's a former KGB agent. And it is so bizarre to sit with a guy who, when I was a child, we all would have said, this guy needs to go to prison or be executed. A guy who is on the other side, a guy who came here just like in the TV show The Americans and lived among us. What a change of heart this guy has had. And what a fascinating story. Part two of the story with Jack Barsky, the author of the book Deep Undercover, My Secret Life in America as a KGB agent. We begin there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Jack Barsky, how are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back.
You bet. It's if you did not watch last night's TV show on The Blaze, you need to. By the way, our apologies. Our IT department is trying to track down, for the first time ever in the history of glennbeck.com and theblaze.com, the Blaze is down, and we don't know why right now. Don't know if we've been hacked or if it was somebody that just kind of tripped over a extension cord.
Jeffy spilled his syrup on the server.
Yeah, it could have been, so we don't know yet. But
I didn't realize that was the server.
theblaze.com is down, and we'll get it up as soon as we can.
I tell you what, it may have something to do with me. listen to me. I did a radio interview with a Catholic radio station. I forgot the program. And at the very moment when I said the word God, I get the busy signal. Their system went down.
Really?
You figure out what that
wow.
was.
Well, you are a good sign. You are a spy. How much disinformation are you giving us here? I started to say, if you've missed last night's TV show, it is a must watch. The audience we had last night, they stood for how long? An hour afterwards?
Pretty much, yeah, till the last person got their signature.
Right. I mean, they were locked in silence the whole time, as was I, hearing this man's story. I've asked him to come back because I want to talk to him about a few things, including current events. Also, it is Good Friday. I want to talk to him a little bit about his transition from a guy who was absolutely godless to a guy now who it says he's kind of on a mission. You have a message to tell and a and can't wait to meet Ravi Zacharias in a couple of weeks. But let me start with this, Jack. We got into the story last night, and the boys didn't hear it, and the radio audience didn't hear it, of how you were captured at the end. You came in the 1970s to America. You are a KGB agent, but you're not Russian. East German. You had a family over in East Germany. They thought you were dead. The KGB had told them that you had died. And you had told the KGB that you had AIDS,
right,
to be able to
disappear.
You wanted to stay here because you had a child here, mm-hmm, but you were lying to your wife here about who you were. She had no idea. You're looking up. Why do you look up like that?
Yeah, it just occurred to me I was lying to everybody, including mm-hmm myself.
Wow. You're still really figuring this all out, aren't you, in your head?
You're right. And every time I speak to somebody like you and they ask questions, I get another revelation. It's just like, you know, because I have scientific training, I'm very analytical, mm-hmm, and I'm still trying to figure me out.
Right.
I'm getting there slowly. There's too much complexity in this kind of a life. And,
people don't understand. If you watch the movie or the TV show The Americans, that's the life without the killing. That's the life that you led, where I don't know. I watch that show and I think to myself, how do they compartmentalize? Jack Barsky's not even your real name. What's your real name?
I hate to pronounce it. It's so hard. It's Albrecht Dittrich.
You stick with Barsky.
Yeah. Gee, why'd you change it in America? It's like one of those languages that's...
Yes.
So when you were... I mean, it's one thing when you have your guard up, mm-hmm, to not reveal yourself. But when you're in love with somebody or you have a relationship, you have kids... How did you separate? How did you compartmentalize everything?
No, you're absolutely right. Compartmentalization is key to survival in that situation. I pretty much manufactured a dual personality for myself. And, you know, it became apparent sort of after 6 years. Every 2 years I went back to Germany and Moscow for debriefing and some R&R. So here I go. Back to Germany, Albrecht Dittrich is going back home to join his family. And after about 4 or 5 weeks, Jack Barsky was happy to be back in America. Mm. And that was a real feeling. All of a sudden I had the two pieces of me had two separate homes.
You never, because Lenin was your hero.
He absolutely was.
Right. And I got the impression this is a rather new journey for you to really look into the history of Lenin. And you found out, wow, he's not the guy. Right? Is this new?
It's fairly new because, you know, I started really digging into the history of the Soviet Union, Russia, the KGB and all that, to get a bit more of a foundation for, you know, occasions like this, you know.
Yeah.
And what I found was eye-opening because at least I was always thinking that there were some good, quote-unquote, revolutionaries and that communism just couldn't work because there were too many bad people involved.
Yeah.
Well, and Lenin was one of the good guys. He sacrificed.
Right.
Well, you know, he was in exile and he lived in a hut in Finland for a year and so, and... Oh, by the way, the reason that I studied 100 words a day in English was because I read somewhere that he, when he studied German, he acquired 100 new words every day. So this is the extent to which I identified with this guy, and he was, you know, my role model. And I found out that the revolutionary who really wanted to save the world from all evil was himself evil. And a lot of my contemporaries in Germany who were communists like me growing up still have not come to that conclusion.
One of the guys on the floor, Travis, I think it was Travis that said, told me about the book, what was the name of that book? Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. I started reading it a couple of days ago, and I thought about you last night as I was reading it, because it talks about cognitive dissonance and how the average person, even when confronted with the absolute truth, they will automatically make excuses and come up with this whole world. That was your world.
It was my world, not anymore. And you said that yesterday. You said something about courage. You will not hear me say ever again, mistakes were made. I made a mistake. I got to own it. I got to own, you know, my past as well as my present, and to the extent possible I have it in the future.
Good for you. I said, what I said about courage was, I think, and I'm beginning to, after we met yesterday, and I had time to digest you, I got up this morning and I thought, I don't think you knew you were being courageous at the time. Yeah. But I said, I think he's one of the most courageous men I've ever met. His story is all about courage. His story is, I grew up in East Germany. I learn a new language. They select me to go over to the United States by myself. I leave. It takes a lot of courage to go be a spy. He's a spy. Then he gets, he's told, you got to get out. They're on to you. He stays. He then lives a dual life, trying to get away from the KGB and the FBI to stay here. He then fesses up when he's caught with the FBI. He then confronts his atheism and decides to look into God. He has every step of the way, and the last one was Lenin, to look into your hero. And you didn't know every step of the way.
No, you're right. And there was one in between that I haven't told you. With Easter coming up, 8 years ago, I gave testimony to a church audience, a large audience, in the area where I worked and lived. And I sort of revealed my past. It was dual courage, probably. One of them was coming out when it wasn't really time to come out. Interestingly enough, there was, you know, somehow nothing ever leaked to my employer or the media or whatever. But the other thing is just testifying to my faith.
Right.
In public.
You're a guy who you grew up, your family and all of society said Christianity is nonsense. It's a fairy tale. You thought Christians were weak and pathetic. You're a guy of science. But there's a book out that talks about Africa. And this guy who went over to Africa said, you can tell where Christian missionaries have been because the people just behave differently. They stand differently. They put their shoulders back and they look at you and they actually look you in the eye. Where the Christian missionaries have not been, everybody looks down. You know, this is all kind of, you know, overblown a bit to make the point. But when you were living in a country that was as paranoid as it feels like, you know, the Eastern Bloc used to be, where you didn't know who the good guy was, you didn't know who the bad guy was, far as, you know, turning families in, and no Christianity. Did you come over here? Is there a difference between the people? Could you see a lot of people say, you know, America is a good place. People are so friendly. They're so open. They're trusting. Was there a difference in the people?
Oh, well, there are too many variables to, like, point out to one thing that makes
people different.
People different, you know, because America is such a, it's not a melting pot, but a conglomeration of all kinds of different nationalities.
Yeah.
And so there's a softness to the average American that you have, not as among Germans, but let me maybe take a different tack. What I do see is, you know, amongst the Christian community, there's a togetherness. There's a trust. There is a fundamental humility that you don't find outside of that community. And this is not so much America and Germany. That's, you know, if I meet a fellow Christian, immediately my guard is coming down. Mm. And that goes both ways.
Weird for you because your guard used to go up. Yeah. You said yesterday humility is the greatest gift you were given.
Yes. And you can't, you know, and humility is probably the most logical thing to acquire. Once you realize, you know, that we are under a mighty God and we are like nothing, absolutely nothing. And, you know, people just are in denial. And that, you know, I think that takes some maturity, if particularly in my case, where I was built up by the society that wanted to use me. They put me on a pedestal. I couldn't do wrong. I had a child out of wedlock. I was a party member. In those days, the party was, you know, very strong with this type of immorality. Nobody ever said peep because I was already a star. So, you know, to come down from that pedestal requires, in my case, a lot of logic.
I'm just jumping all around because I have so many things that I want to talk to you about. You had a dual life. You had a family over in East Germany. You had a family over here. Neither of them knew about the other. You were balancing that. You were spying on America. You thought you were doing the right thing at the time. You saw us as you saw us as the enemy. You said yesterday that the KGB was incompetent, and we were talking about how perhaps we would have lost the war had they been the guys that we thought that they were. But I want to talk to you a little bit about how they read the assassination of Ronald Reagan and what your thoughts were on the assassination of Ronald Reagan, what that meant to you or what you felt on that day. We'll get to that here in a second.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Sign up for the newsletter and get all the info you need to know at glennbeck.com.
Talking to Jack Barsky, you must read this book. It's called Deep Undercover, My Secret Life, Entangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. Fascinating guy who now is an American and loves America. I can't believe we're sitting here with a guy who, Boris and Natasha, and we admire him, but we really do admire him. I want to talk to him a little bit when we come back about when he was here, he came under Jimmy Carter and the assassination of Ronald Reagan. Assassination of Ronald Reagan. How he felt about that, his capture, and his bringing together of his two families. Fascinating story. When we come back.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Back with Jack Barsky, former KGB agent. Before we get back into your story, one of the headlines today is British intelligence passed on Russian intelligence on Donald Trump's team. Do you have any opinion on what's happening with the Russian spy thing?
Well, obviously, I don't have any inside information. At least I'm telling you that.
Yeah.
Anyway, but what my concern is that right now there is so much buzz in the media, and there's so many talking heads on TV that speculate about intelligence-related activities when they have no clue. Period. Now, even if there's a there's a legitimate leak coming out of the intelligence community, you don't know. It could be, it could say one thing.
Disinformation.
It's a world that, you know, can be compared to the Hall of Mirrors. You don't really know what's real. So this is a very difficult subject. You know, on the one hand, you got to have an intelligence organization. But you also need to supervise them and make sure that they don't go rogue. On the other hand, you need to let them do what they do.
And right.
A lot of interference comes by talking about this stuff and just like handcuffing your intelligence organization.
You told me yesterday a couple of times the biggest fear that you have is that we are headed towards authoritarianism, the kind of authoritarianism that you grew up with in the former Soviet Union. The intelligence community, we have tried to keep it non-political, but I think we have really lost the political war with the intelligence community. I think there's a lot of great agents and a lot of people right at the top that are guarding against it. But the political system on both sides of the aisle are trying to kind of co-opt our intelligence community for political reasons. And I think that's wildly dangerous.
It absolutely is. And, you know, when this, the rumors about, you know, the Russian hacking on the one hand and Trump mentioning that he was wiretapped on the other hand, when these rumors were flying back and forth, what that did, it put the focus in the public discourse on something that shouldn't be in focus. You know, it's like, okay, so all of a sudden we got to a point that, you know, Republicans are the biggest enemy for Democrats and vice versa, when in fact we have real adversaries and real enemies.
Do you know who Alexander Dugin is?
No, sir.
I would love for you to read some of his stuff and watch him in his native tongue. I think he's the most dangerous man on the planet today. He's one of the main advisors, of Putin. And he has for a long time talked about disinformation, getting into America, dropping, you know, spies, causing trouble, using the internet to flood it with lies. And turn us against each other.
Mm-hmm.
People have a hard time. Here I am sitting with a former KGB agent who was sent here in the 70s to spy on us and live amongst us. And people feel that, you know, Putin trying to hack into to affect our elections or, you know, setting up disinformation centers is just conspiracy theories. Of course they're trying to do that. And they're telling us they're trying to do that.
Absolutely.
And I bet we do that.
Yes. Yes. And with regard to disinformation, nowadays we call it fake news. Well,
yeah.
The KGB has a history of successfully planting false information in the West. Probably one of the most bizarre and interesting cases was that J. Edgar Hoover is known to have been a secret cross-dresser. That was planted by the KGB. That is documented.
Was it really?
Was planted by the KGB. It was given to a friendly source, a journalist in France, who then published it in a newspaper that had some, you know, it had some credence. And then
it
blew up. And there's still quite a few Americans who are interested in history and so forth who think that there was something wrong with J. Edgar Hoover. It's not true. And there's many other
things. This is coming from a guy who you must have hated J. Edgar Hoover. When
I
you
did.
Came here.
You know, I thought he was a he was a slime ball.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about the day that Ronald Reagan was shot from your perspective. There are stories that the KGB geared up for a coup. It's what would have happened in Russia. And they just kind of geared up expecting that there would be a coup. What happened on that day with you?
Well, I was here in my third year in the United States, and my existence was that of a lowly bike messenger in Manhattan. I didn't have any information coming from the center to me about right. this, so I can't really tell you what their reaction was.
What was your reaction? 3 years in, Ronald Reagan, who you thought was a really bad guy.
Well, I thought he was an idiot, actually.
Did you really?
Yeah, sure. How can somebody call ketchup a vegetable? You must be really stupid. And there was something else about trees polluting. That's and you know, I bought into the left wing
story
about Reagan, and I had manufactured myself sort of a left wing personality within the United States, so I could sort of live with myself as a communist. I couldn't possibly pretend to be right wing. So
yeah.
But anyway, when Ronald Reagan was shot, that really actually came and went. And when I went back to Moscow the year later, this was not discussed anymore. So I have no glimpse as to. I'm pretty sure there was a flare up of activities for a bit, but I didn't get to sense or feel anything.
Did you ever have? Were you ever tempted to just bare your soul to somebody? Did you ever have? Did you ever find kindred spirits that you were just like, oh, you know what, I can trust? Or were you just so barricaded inside of yourself?
While I was active, no, there was never.
So let me ask you this. What is it like to live wholly inside of yourself?
It's lonely, and eventually that erupted. You know, you can keep it in only so long. And I'm talking about the emotional eruption, which also has something to do with, you know, coming to Christ.
Yeah.
Right? Because that loneliness, there's a poem. Yeah, I'm not a poet. I wrote two poems in my life. One is a love poem for my current wife, and the other one has a heading. It's called Loneliness. It's in the book. And it was a cry for, like, you know, describing what it is, what it feels to be lonely within yourself, and a cry for, you know, salvation, so to speak.
You had two wives, one over in the former Soviet Union in West and East Germany, and you had a child, a son.
Mm-hmm.
They were told you were dead. You then married a woman here to help her become legal. You did not tell her who you were.
Right.
You had a child with her who you absolutely adore, your daughter. You actually got caught because somebody buried some cans with your name in it. And then they were wiretapping your house. Can you tell that story real quick?
So my name was amongst the documents that a former archivist of the KGB smuggled out of KGB archives and shared with MI5, which then trickled over to the FBI. And
the name Jack Barsky.
Jack Barsky and undercover sort of was.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have much more information, but, you know, they weren't. And there aren't too many Jack Barskys in this country, so very quickly they zeroed in on me, who I lived at the time in rural Pennsylvania.
And you were no longer a KGB agent.
Oh no, I wasn't. I was done.
Yeah.
I was completely, in the clear.
And you thought nobody's looking for me anymore.
Yes,
I'm fine.
I knew that I would finish my life out as a middle class Americans with a family, a house. And never get to see Germany again.
Yeah.
That was all done. And so the FBI, once they knew that I was their target, they did a 3.5-year investigation, very carefully, very methodically, because they knew I was a well-trained agent, but they didn't know whether I was still active, whether I was a sleeper. So they went about it very slowly.
And they actually wiretapped your house. They eavesdropped on all your conversations?
First of all, they bought my neighbor's house when that came on the market and had two agents live there.
Had no idea?
Jeez. I had no idea.
Wow. Wow.
And then they wiretapped my house and actually got a confession on tape.
Now listen to this. This is fantastic. Having an argument with his wife, he thinks he's pulling out the biggest Trump card in the world, because she's like, you've never done anything for me. You know, typical, you know, you don't care about me.
Typical Tuesday.
Right. Yeah. And then Jack responds.
I told her, hey, listen, I pretty much risk everything for you and Chelsea, because I used to be a KGB agent. And when they called me home, I decided to defy them and stay here.
And yeah. How about that?
Yeah, in your face.
How about that?
Yeah, okay. You take out the garbage.
So now
he says...
That was such a manly argument, and right. It backfired with a woman, right?
Right, he had no idea that she... Because he said that, and I'm such... You know, I'm practically all chick. I immediately thought what his wife thought. What else are you lying to me about?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, of course.
You married me so I could be a citizen. You're not even a citizen. Now I'm wrapped in with this. Now I'm going to get kicked out if you get caught. I mean, it...
You should have been my advisor. In
those days. No, bad idea, Jack.
This is exactly right. And, you know, I'm still falling for this, you know, and making this a male argument to a female. It doesn't work.
No, that was a bad idea.
Yeah, and the FBI had my confession on tape. And
so now you didn't tell your daughter. Mm. Did you tell your daughter right after that, before you got caught?
No, I told her well after I got caught. When she turned 18.
And you were crossing a bridge, and you paid your toll. Mm. And as you paid your toll, you saw a state trooper.
State trooper. He flagged me down, and he indicated that it was a routine traffic stop. So yeah, okay. So I pulled over to the side. And then he asked me to get out of the car, which I thought was a bit unusual, but, you know, whatever. I get out of the car, and then I see, sort of out of the corner of my eye, somebody coming in from the back. And before I could process all of this, a fellow comes up to me and holds a badge. I didn't bother to read the badge, and he said, FBI, we would like to talk to you.
And you knew.
Bam.
Okay, more on this in just a second.
Glenn Beck program.
888-727 back.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck program.
I want to get to the what happened after Jack was caught coming up in just a second. Talking to former KGB spy here in America, author of the book Deep Undercover. It is an unbelievable story. His life story is absolutely remarkable. Everybody who has read this book has come in and said, I could not put it down. And that's the way we feel about the 3 hours now that we have spent with you. You're just fascinating. We were just talking in the break that most journalists, you know, they have an agenda, and they're not really listening to you. They just want you to they want you to say what they want you to say. And that's what they do. And you started talking about being on with, what's his name in the morning on? Chris Cuomo.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience. It was in studio, and most shows have some kind of an agenda, and it's very narrowly focused. And this one was focused on, you know, they had a chart of all the connections that
Putin and Trump
that the Trump folks had with Russia.
Yeah,
and so Mr. Cuomo has been trying to sort of agree with him that there is some kind of collusion, and he was digging like several times and he just kept and I wouldn't go there. I said I have no knowledge of this, and B, and I'm not going to continue, I'm not joining the speculation. And eventually
he gave up. Jack Barsky, more in a second, and the news of the day. It is Good Friday. Back in a second.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck program. The U.S. Air Force is conducting a massive surprise exercise, a warning to North Korea. It's why I believe we dropped the mother of all bombs yesterday to send a message to North Korea. They have another nuclear missile test. This one could be the red line, according to our sources in Washington, D.C. This is what a perfect weekend to pray and repent. Because this is going to be a tough weekend. Also, Donald Trump's base, is it turning on him? An update from yesterday's program. Camden Maples, this is the kid, the 7-year-old that was taken from the family, hardworking family. We're having a hard time making ends meet. Yesterday, they said they had a goal of $10,000 just to be able to pay for the attorneys. As of last night when I went to bed, their GoFundMe page was at $11,000. So thank you to this audience for helping that family out. And Jack Barsky joined us yesterday. We're going to spend a few more minutes with Jack talking about his incredible life story as a former KGB spy here in America, an atheist that found God, a communist that found capitalism, a former East German who found his love for America. The end of his tale, right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I'm going to ask Jack to do the impossible thing and tell us the amazing story of the reuniting of his family. He is the author of Deep Undercover, a great book, the story of his life as an undercover KGB agent here in America. Here is a KGB agent in the 70s and the 80s. You decide to leave the agency. You tell the agency that you have AIDS because you knew that they wouldn't want somebody coming back to the Soviet Union with AIDS. So you tell them you have AIDS. You fall off the radar. KGB pretty much leaves you alone. They tell your family, your wife and your child, your son in East Germany, that you're dead. They believe it. You've married another woman to make her a legal American citizen. You have a daughter with her. You fall in love with your daughter. You're stuck. It's why you leave the agencies, because of your daughter. You then think for a while you're safe. Nobody's after you. We left the story at the bridge. The FBI has been spying on you. They heard you confess to your wife that you were a former KGB agent. They nab you on the bridge. They pump you for all kinds of information, and you give them information. You're now an American citizen, but there's one door that you haven't opened and you don't want to open, and that is the door of the relationship with your son in Germany.
Right. And, you know, I was fundamentally afraid. I was a coward to actually face the ones that I deserted.
Now, he didn't really know you because he had...
He didn't know me very well.
Yeah. And he was very young when you left.
And the last time I met him, he was 5 years old, and he has very little memory of a father.
Okay.
So I just wanted to stay out of that realm altogether. But when my daughter turned 18, I gave her... And, you know, I told her about my background.
How did she react to that? Hey, honey, I used to be a KGB agent.
Yes, and she actually cried because she grasped, unlike my ex-wife, she grasped the sacrifice that I had made on her behalf. And what better proof that a child is loved than, you know, a parent making a sacrifice?
Did she have a moment of... Dad, what else haven't you told me?
Actually not.
Really?
It was all good. It was really very good. And when I hinted that, and I said, oh, by the way, you have a half-brother in Germany, that triggered something in her that eventually brought the family together. She coaxed the name out of me, and then she started an intense internet search. And after a couple of years, she never gave up. She found him, sent him an email.
And you did not want to meet him.
No, I didn't. And I didn't know what she was doing in the background. So, and then she, once they found each other, they interacted via email for a while. Then she, in a stealth maneuver, you know, she's a daughter of a spy, right?
Mm-hmm.
She brought him to the U.S. And without telling me, one day I got a call from a restaurant, which was 4 miles from my house. And she says, "Dad, your son Matthias and I are over there. Would you like to join us?" And she forced my hand. You know,
and what are you going
to
do?
At that point, you know, do I admit to my beloved daughter that I'm such a coward that I couldn't see my son? And so I went. And that was the beginning of a healing process that eventually brought this family together.
You're close with him now.
We're close. We spent some time together in Florida last fall. Now
you were raised as a chemist. You were trained as a chemist. You're obviously very, very bright. KGB, you don't apply. KGB finds you.
That's right.
And they found you because you were very bright and scientifically minded. And you came in. You were not a KGB guy. You know, with the polonium, you know, 212 and all of that stuff. You came in to do kind of some espionage without any of the killing. You were just kind of planted in the old MetLife building up in New York.
Mm-hmm.
You are not a Christian at all. Had really kind of contempt for the idea that, you know, contempt in the way that it's a fairy tale, guys. How stupid do you have to believe? Have to believe in God. And you met your now current wife,
right?
Who started as your administrative assistant,
right?
And you wanted to see how smart she was,
right?
And so you asked, "I'd like to see some of your work, your studies." And what'd she do?
Well, she attended Philadelphia Bible College. And so she gave me an essay on the Book of Ruth.
And you're thinking first when you hire, you're like, "Oh, geez, I hope she's not a holy roller."
Yes, I was. But at that point, I wasn't. I had dropped my hatred for Christianity. I wasn't an aggressive atheist anymore. Mm-hmm. I just like.
Were you aggressive atheist of?
At one point, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I had met too many good Christians to like hate them, you know. Yeah. I just said, I told my admin at the time, I told her, "I'm an agnostic, you know. You can do what you want to do, and I, you know, I believe what I believe in, which is I don't know anything really." Mm-hmm. That's a cop out, but
yeah.
You know, it was convenient at the time. But you know, she sort of opened the door, because once I read the essay and I said, "This is pretty well written, but does it justice to the original?" And out comes the Bible. She was ready.
She knew.
She was ready. She pulled that out. She is a very aggressive evangelist, and she felt that there was a way to lead me to God. And the most critical moment was when she told me to listen to this radio program, "Let My People Think," that
Ravi
is still
Zacharias.
On by Ravi Zacharias.
Right. Amazing man.
And
he is the C.S. Lewis of our time. If you don't know who Ravi Zacharias is, Google him. Watch some of his YouTube videos. He goes into universities. I think he's at Oxford. He goes into universities. He speaks to atheists, but has a dialogue. He's not trying to win. He's not trying to argue. He just wants to have a dialogue. And he is absolutely brilliant. If you're like Jack, you're science-minded.
Yes.
He's brilliant.
Yes. And so this was the first time that I heard somebody made a philosophically, logically sound argument for God. And what particularly attracted me, and this is one of the core pieces of his message, is that there is no morality without a God.
What does that mean to you?
What that means to me, that, you know, because I realized, you know, looking back at my life, I always thought of myself as a good person. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm intrinsically good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then you come to terms that I did a lot of bad things. Mm-hmm. Never mind breaking laws. I hurt people. I did bad things. I served a bad cause. So, and I realized that the goodness doesn't come from the inside.
It takes down people like Lenin and Stalin. And,
yes, it does.
And, you know, even people on our side, it takes these guys down. Doesn't matter what the society thinks or what the leader thinks.
Yes, and so and in addition, then Shauna, my now wife, told me to just read some C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, and this is all, you know, and I just like said, yeah, I can go with that. And on top of it, I had this spiritual emotional need that I was talking to you about this
very poem,
Loneliness. So she took me to her church, and the sermon was just like overwhelming. In that the pastor mentioned the word love about 30, 40 times.
As the old Jack, as the guy whose name I can't pronounce, what's your real name?
Albrecht Dietrich.
Okay, that guy. what would you say to that guy? That he would understand, because you're now saying, you know, he said love and this feeling would say, would look at you and say, I get it. I mean, but that's fairy tales and you're talking about feelings. What would you say to yourself 30 years ago to explain?
To my young self, and you know, this would all be a logical argument, not so much about the feeling, because my young self didn't really know that feeling was an intrinsical part of being a person, right? Of being a human being. But I would make the logical argument. It says, hey, listen, you're a scientist. Look, dig into this. Open your ears, open your mind. Let the message come in and then decide for yourself. Because my young self was, ideas other than what was preached in our communist society were not coming in.
There is a movement now underfoot for socialism. I mean, 60% of millennials, maybe even be higher now, think that Marxism, socialism, it's all great. What would you say, especially to people who didn't grow up in the Cold War like we did, what would you say to them about what they're being taught?
Well, it's a great dream, right? It's just this romantic notion that, you know, everybody can get along. It's the denial of evil in this world. It's sticking your head in the sand and dreaming that, you know, it's all about feelings and feeling good, and it's in defiance of reality. And as a matter of fact, the communist ideal, as appealing as it might be, has never been implemented. Maybe in small communities, mm-hmm. like a kibbutz, mm-hmm. or, you know, amongst mm-hmm. the Mennonites in this country, mm-hmm. but not as in a country, in a state. So every country in history that sort of started out with a communist ideology became very quickly a dictatorship, and some of them just as bad, if not worse, than the Hitler dictatorship, Mao, Stalin. So kids, is that what you want?
What do you want to go from here, Jack? You said to me yesterday you really want to go talk to colleges.
Yes, I do, and I hope I get in one of those days and explain to them exactly, you know, what my experiences are, and let's not repeat history and go down that path again, because if you don't take ownership of your own lives, if you don't open your minds, you will easily fall prey to one of those dictator types that will usurp your movement, your romantic notion that everything will be good, and you start following somebody, and you go down that rat hole where you really don't want to go there. Now, this message needs to be honed, right? I'm working on it.
Yeah. You're a work in progress.
Yes, sir. Still am.
How long have you been reborn?
8 years.
What do you say to people who say, hey, Glenn Beck, how dare you even host this guy? Why are you giving this guy a platform? He's a guy who was trying to take down our country.
Uh-huh. Let me quote, and this is a secondary quote I got from a friend who knows socially Louis Free, who was the FBI director when my case was hot. And he told my friend that I did great service to this country. It's not me saying it.
Well, to tell you this, the guy who wrote the foreword for his book is the FBI guy that busted him.
Mm. Right.
I mean, they didn't bust you, and you're not here just because, like, let's bygones be bygones.
That's not the way that works.
You were busted here, and you went to work for the government
and you helped.
Ways.
Yes, I was a trusted source for the FBI for 13 years or so, and I hope I helped. And they tell me that I did.
The good thing on this show is with Jeffy, even KGB agents are never the worst person on the show.
You got
that going for you.
No, and he never killed anybody. He could have come in a blood suit, and he still wouldn't be as bad as Jeffy. The name of the book is Deep Undercover by Jack Barsky, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB Spy in America. Fascinating, Jack, and I hope we see each other again. Thank you so much.
I hope so, too.
Back in just a second.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
Is Politico overstating this? Political headline, Trump's base turns on him. I'm not sure that's true.
There's not polling to support that yet.
Yeah.
However,
I don't think it is true.
There is there are a lot of high profile Trump supporters do seem to be turning on him a little
bit. I really think, you know, this whole Bannon thing about, you know, another headline today is will Bannon seek revenge? I mean, he is a burn it down to the ground kind of guy. He believes burn the system to the ground and then we can start all over again, which I think is madness. But I don't think there's a chance that he leaves the White House and doesn't turn Breitbart against Trump or whatever.
I think there's a chance, but we've seen this with some of the high profile departures that
Lewandowski,
Roger Stone, that have not turned on him and have been able to utilize from the outside their relationships still to their advantage.
Yeah. So maybe.
But I mean, it does feel like it's going that way right now. I mean, there's a lot of speculation.
At least on Trump's side.
Yeah. I mean, you know, his comments, he's just some guy. He's some guy who works for me. He didn't come around till later in the campaign. There is a lot of speculation that he's not going to make it to Monday. I mean, I don't know if that's true. It seems impossible.
The thing that I worry about are the people that said that really truly feel like they were not being heard, and they bought into the China is stealing your jobs, and I'm going to put trade war with China and the currency manipulator, and then he reverses himself this week on all of that. You kind of feel like, has he become Paul Ryan? Is he just become another Republican sellout that said one thing on the campaign trail and now is doing another? I worry about those people who are really suffering.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
About 10 miles from the city Al-Kosh in Iraq is a major Christian center in the Middle East. Now, this is the place in the Middle East where a lot of the stuff in the Old Testament happened. This is a place where the Christians have grabbed some of the remains of the Old Testament prophets and have moved them, buried them secretly, protected real relics of the Bible. And these are the people that, quite frankly, Mercury One has helped move a lot of these people to other countries. Everybody, almost everybody that we have moved, have said they want to go back. They only want to get away temporarily with their family. They don't want to stay. They feel it's important as a Christian to go back to the birthplace of God or of man. So there's this place called Telscof, and this is where, if you remember, Charles Keating, the Navy SEAL, he was killed as he was rescuing Christians from ISIS. That happened back in 2006. It was overtaken by ISIS in 2015, and it became a virtual ghost town as everybody, all the Christians, were leaving. This is one of the front lines for the Peshmerga, the Kurdistan regional government. And the army was able to stop ISIS from destroying it entirely. But it's rubble. The church in Telscof is the, I'm trying to find the name of it, it's the St. George Church in Telscof. It is the center of this community and the center of the Christian faith in all of Iraq. And our people on the ground at Mercury One saw, and we've been working with the Christians on the ground, and as we were getting people out of the area, and they all said, we've got to go back and we've got to rebuild St. George's, because it is the church for Christianity in Iraq. We listened to that, and as it has been taken back from ISIS, it was in really bad shape. In fact, we're seeing pictures up. If you're watching theblaze.com, this is a community that takes their faith very seriously. There are lots of crosses on homes, and as ISIS was approaching, they didn't take the crosses down. And this church was in really, really bad shape. Bullet holes all the way through it. They had really destroyed it and desecrated. I mean, look at the shape of that church. Mercury One has gone in, and we took the bulldozers and helped clear some of the streets and have put the church into good enough shape to be able to reopen the church for the very first time, Easter. People are coming back from all over, and they are returning to the center, the heart of Christian Iraq this weekend. There's the picture of it now. Look at that. And we have restored it, and isn't that amazing?
Wow, that's a huge... huge difference. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done yet, but we wanted to get it into shape to where people could...
Easter service, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
People could come back and worship God on Easter Sunday in Iraq.
Yeah.
And this would not have happened had it not been for this audience. And we can't thank you enough. There's a lot of work yet to be done, but we want to thank you for contributing to the Nazarene Fund and saving the people that we have saved. Please keep the rescue team mission specialists in your prayers. We still have not heard from them. They went out and they rescued a woman and her two children. They were recaptured. Mercury One, the team, recaptured them again for the good side. They're now in safety, but we have lost two of our team.
They're still missing. Huh?
They're still missing. They're not Americans, but they are still missing, and we're really afraid that, not that they're dead. We know where they're going. If they're dead, it would be a horrible tragedy, but we're really afraid that they have been captured and are being used for sport by ISIS. So this Easter, please, please keep that Mercury team in mind. It's Good Friday today. And I said this earlier this week, and I just want to say it again. It's really easy to look at Jesus and say, yeah, I want to be like that. But we all say that, I want to be kinder. I want to be more forgiving. I want to be whatever. Until we're actually faced with somebody who it's really hard to forgive. Once it gets a little bit difficult, we kind of forget that being Christ-like means putting yourself up on the cross, forgetting about yourself and doing the right thing for others. And how many times I have failed. We all do. These Christians in the Middle East, they didn't take the crosses down from their doors. It was a death sentence. And most of them said, I don't want to stay in Slovakia. I don't want to stay in Australia. I want to go home. When ISIS is gone, I want to go home. Not because it's my home and I want to be there, but because I have a responsibility for the faith. We cannot let Christianity die in the Middle East. That's what they say. Consider Good Friday as part of the Easter package.
Would that even enter into your thinking if you were in that position? If Texas was in that position? I don't think that would even enter into my thinking. I'm gonna leave.
Well, it really
take my family to safety
in a different totally different circumstances. It's why we moved here. Texas was losing its Texas. It was losing its Texas. We found out. Remember, we found out that you couldn't teach the Alamo in the schools of Texas because it was too...
You could teach it, but you had to teach it from the Mexican perspective.
Right, which is a total lie.
Yeah.
We were helping the Mexicans become free of a tyrant. And you can't teach that in Texas. And we thought, if we lose Texas, but there's no danger to us.
Right.
And in fact, there was a lot of safety in Texas compared to New York City.
Yeah. Yes.
So...
Yeah,
I can't imagine.
It's pretty amazing.
I can't imagine.
Luckily, the world's not a dangerous place right now. There's really nothing much to
know. There's nothing to really take note of.
Right. I mean, for example, yes, we fired a bunch of missiles in Syria last week. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And that was largely seen as kind of partially at least a message to North Korea, nuclear power. Yeah. And then, you know, we dropped the mother of all bombs.
The Moab.
In Afghanistan. And that was also kind of seen as a message to North Korea, nuclear power. And then we conducted a massive surprise Air Force exercise
in a message to North Korea, a nuclear power,
which was kind of interesting. And then this report from NBC News yesterday, the U.S. is prepared to launch a preemptive strike with conventional weapons against North Korea should officials become convinced that North Korea is about to follow through with their nuclear weapons test. Korea... is a nuclear power.
That would be sort of a message to North Korea,
who's a nuclear power, by the way.
Wait.
Repeat that headline. That's the first time I've heard that.
That's amazing.
The U.S. is prepared to launch a preemptive strike with conventional weapons against North Korea should officials become convinced that North Korea is about to follow through with a nuclear weapons test, multiple senior U.S. intelligence officials told NBC News.
They are absolutely going to follow through with that nuclear weapons. They do that every time on Saturday.
Saturday's the day they believe it would happen. So that's
every year they do a show of strength on that anniversary.
What's that anniversary? Of 105, right?
Yeah,
since
the year 105.
The dear leader.
Yeah.
And when you get used to writing 104 on your checks, it's got to be so difficult to start doing 105.
Yeah.
I don't even know how they do it over there.
It's a good point. It is a good point. They have two destroyers capable of shooting Tomahawk missiles into the region. One is just 300 miles from the North Korean nuclear test site. NBC News also has a map of exactly why they believe this test is coming, yeah. showing the site where they believe it's coming from, showing, you know, that water is not flowing from one area and debris is not being pushed into this other area where it always is. And
are they,
there's a small thing,
they've evacuated.
Are they saying it's a foregone conclusion that if they do the test, we're going to attack?
No, he said... The statement was, if we believe they're going to.
Well, yeah. We do believe they're going to.
Well, we know they're going to shoot. They're probably going to shoot rockets off, right? We don't know that.
So here's what we need to pray for. We need to pray for two things. One, that China has our back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think they do. I'm not sure, but I think they do.
They seem like it this week.
Well, I mean, the chocolate cake in Mar-a-Lago was good.
Right. So. If the chocolate cake was good enough,
I'm all for that.
And China is with us, we have a chance. However, the North Korean leader believes he can defeat us.
I know.
And he's just crazy enough.
Come on.
The CIA, I talked to a guy who just left the CIA. He said, Glenn, we are all convinced that this guy, and I think so, he said he's not Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-il was crazy, but he also had some sense to him and, you mm-hmm. know, knew that he was, mm-hmm. you know, who he was. He said this guy is, they believe, truly nuts. Truly nuts.
Well, you'd have to be. He'd have to be delusional to believe that North Korea could defeat the United States.
And, of course, he is delusional, which is a risky thing.
Yeah, correct.
They are saying, however, because, I mean, the risk here is not necessarily to the United States immediately.
South Korea.
It's South Korea.
Oh, I know. Seoul would be gone in an hour.
They are saying South Korea would have to sign off on this if we were to actually take this action.
And I'm guessing they won't. I mean, that really imperils their capital city. And 10 million people
could be dead within 2 minutes.
I mean, I don't know if his first response would be nuclear, but they could certainly shell the city with a lot of conventional.
Who was it that told us that within 2 hours he could flatten it with conventional weapons?
Yeah.
I mean, and there's not much to flatten in his country. You can fire a lot of things there.
China's concern is as well is that if you start knocking out North Korea, they'll have refugees.
Right.
North Koreans will just plow into China.
Oh, yeah. And that's why they're saying, but have you guys seen evidence of this?
Of the troops?
130 troops on the border.
150,000.
Yeah.
Seen it reported.
I haven't seen any evidence of it, and I'm not sure if that's even true.
And you'd think we'd have evidence of that. It's 2017. Yeah. You could look at that from satellites.
I mean, we're looking at where they have tents set up for the celebration of the Day of Sun. You think we'd be able to see 150,000?
So I said, I have a friend who's on vacation, and they said they wrote and said, "I'm on vacation. I haven't been paying attention to the news at all. Anything going on?" And I said,
"No."
I said, "Relax." I really wrote, "Relax. Everything is the same. The world will be exactly the same when you get back on Monday." Then the next text was ... unless North Korea vaporizes Seoul, then we
things
could
might be a little different.
Then one day you could come back to World War III.
Good morning, everybody.
That's it.
Happy Friday.
It's a pretty amazing
beautiful
weekend.
Beautiful day out there today.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
Boy, I would batten down the hatches. We just got some new information. Russia is moving artillery and troops onto the North Korean-Russian border. And China, within the hour, has just canceled all flights into North Korea and out of North Korea. Both countries seem to be anticipating some sort of strike this weekend. It can change the world in a heartbeat. More in a second.
Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
As we look at possibly another military conflict. And this one, if everything is not exactly right, this one could quickly shove us into World War III. As we're looking at, just found out in the last hour that Russia is moving equipment and artillery into the Russian zone right on the North Korean border. We have reports that 150 or 130,000 troops from China are on the North Korea border. We said that if we found that they were going to do another missile test tomorrow, that we will first strike. They have enough artillery, and they have as many to 6 to 8 nuclear warheads. They could vaporize Seoul in about 2 minutes. And even if they only used conventional weapons, they could kill 10 million people probably within about 3 hours. This is a very tense weekend in the world. And as we are flexing our muscles, dropping bombs from the sky like Moab, we have a story to tell you that you know in your heart is true. But here is evidence. Remember how we have all said, hey, why are we disarming our own guys because of our, quote, allies in Afghanistan? Why are we letting all these guys come in to our camp and they're shooting us, but nobody's really saying anything? How many of them are spies? How many of them are good guys, bad guys? We're going to tell you the story of Captain Roger Hill that is unfortunately going to make you sick to your stomach. Before we go into another theater of war, maybe you should hear what the rules of engagement and how we're conducting this war. You should hear the truth about that first. We begin there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Captain Roger Hill, he is the author of a book called Dog Company. There are two books that I'm telling you, if you want to read about what life is really like, the one, Deep Undercover by Jack Barsky, had Jack on for the last couple of days, and now Roger Hill, Dog Company. The true story of American soldiers abandoned by their high command. I warn you that you will not be able to put this down, but it is. This is hard to say. Possibly more frustrating than what you know about Benghazi, because you know this, and this is, I believe, still going on. Captain, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Roger Hill, so you know, you didn't get a dishonorable discharge?
Other than honorable, it's a general. There are 4 classifications of discharges. Okay. There's a graduated schedule where you receive less benefits based on where you are on that scale.
Okay. When you hear why he's receiving less benefits, it'll boil your blood. First, let me start here. You're half Korean.
I am.
Your dad met your mom. He was an American soldier.
He was. He was in the Army, stationed there as his first assignment. And they met on one of the bases that she worked on as a secretary.
And how's your family feeling this weekend?
Probably pretty tense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been on the road a lot lately, so I haven't had a chance to really talk to everybody great deal. But yeah, certainly.
You concerned about another theater of war?
I am. We've done a lot of damage to the military, not just to our military capability outright in terms of technology and manpower, but also to what I think is one of the most valuable ingredients to success in any military or political option being exercised at that level. I think we've really damaged our national will because we've so mismanaged this past conflict.
I know... I have grown a lot and used to be a pretty big hawk because I believe the military, if I were president, the only time I would use the military would be to teach somebody a lesson. Don't ever do that again. And we would be on and gone.
Yeah.
We fight to kill your team faster than you can kill our team. And I hope to approach a speed of killing so overwhelming to you that you drop your gun and say, okay, no more. That's the way you're supposed to fight.
Absolutely. I mean, you should know that my parents gave me the middle name of Truman as well.
Wow.
And I'm a fourth generation veteran. So that gives you a little perspective on sort of the outlook and the worldview that I have.
So, and that's kind of weird because I know some Koreans who do not like Truman.
Yeah.
At all. So tell me the story of what happened to you. And I want the audience to understand this is still, and you know it when you hear it, you know it. It's still happening. And we have got to stop this. Go ahead.
Yes. So 2008, 2009, my first sergeant, Tommy Scott, and myself, we led a heavy weapons company in a very violent province in eastern Afghanistan. And it just seemed like the enemy was always one step ahead of us. The ambushes got progressively worse. We had a 90-man company. At about the six-month mark, we were looking at about 30 wounded in action to include two killed at that point in time.
Was that higher
it's,
than?
It's a little on the higher end of things. Yeah, certainly.
And this is your company, so you're taking this personally.
This is Dog Company, the company yep. The story's about. We were able to enlist the support of a counter-intel team. That counter-intel team uncovered 12 spies working on my base. These spies were, and this kind of gets into the immigration debate just a little bit as of recent, these spies were Afghan workers that our government had hired and vetted to support us on the base so that we could focus on operations outside the base. So day laborers, people that were doing construction, cleaning, cooking, and then one of which was my personal translator, which was heartbreaking. In Afghanistan at that time, there was a policy, a rule of engagement that you had to bring formal charges against any enemy combatants that you brought off the battlefield within 4 days. Just insane.
Okay, stop. I want focus for a minute. Focus if you're driving, still focus on driving, but focus for a minute on what he's about to tell you. You're on the battlefield.
Yeah.
You see a guy with a rifle pointed at you, shooting at you.
Yeah.
You don't kill him. Somehow or another, you capture him.
Yeah.
You bring him in, and then what?
So I'll break there for just a second because I've got a vignette, and we'll come back to this timeline. There was an incident in a valley not too far from where our base was where we did get into a firefight with a group of enemy fighters. We pushed through the ambush line, kill a couple of guys. We captured one. We'd blown his arm off. This is a heavy weapons company, so Mark 19 grenade launchers, 50 cal machine guns. I mean, body parts come off when we start mm-hmm. putting rounds downrange. We put a tourniquet on his arm. We patch him up. We bring him back. We don't have the level of care necessary on our small outpost, so we send him higher. I mean, we're demonstrating a great deal of compassion here, right? He gets patched up, sent back to us 2 weeks later. You know, his arm is all shown up. He's got a nub here on the left side. Yeah, and the command gives me instructions, me personally, to take him back to the point of capture and release him. So I say, are you kidding me? What are you talking about? Well, he's outside the four-day window, and you didn't build an evidence packet against him. So you've got to take him back to the place that you captured him and release him again, the same place that we just got ambushed in. So that's the level of insanity we have been and continue to deal with. Back to the story. We were also dealing with a flow of intelligence, credible intelligence, that was stating that the enemy was planning a large-scale attack against our base. We were making calls to my command to come pick these detainees up. They were unable or would not do so. So out of that 96-hour window, the 4 days that I just spoke of, we're now at about the 80-hour mark. my first sergeant and I decide, hey, let's go interrogate these guys. We don't have time. If these guys get released, they know way too much about us, especially my interpreter. Think about it. This guy's been in all our briefings.
He knows. This is a guy that intelligence has already come back and said, these guys are spies.
Incontrovertible evidence.
Yes.
Yeah, they're definitely bad guys. Okay.
And you know now that the evidence that they have given to the, or the information that they have given is being used to plot against the base and come after and kill, try to kill everybody on the base.
And they've already gotten a number of our guys hurt, maimed, killed at this point.
Yep.
So we decide to run a ruse, which is legal according to the laws of warfare. But here's the issue. The U.S. government, especially over the past 8 or 10 years, has pushed an agenda of applying rule of law as we see it here in the U.S. in a combat zone.
That's insane.
So that makes running a ruse like the one I'm about to describe illegal. So I pull the detainees that I think are less valuable based on the intel that I have. Keep in mind, at this time, I have a top secret clearance out of a building. Leave the ones that are on the inside that have ties to Iran and Iraq. I can't go into detail on that, but pretty bad stuff. And we want to scare them into talking. So a couple of guys get open hand slapped, right? They were not hurt. The division, when they investigated us for these actions after the fact, ran medical evaluations, well documented. None of these guys were hurt.
Please tell me you didn't have dogs barking near them.
No.
Okay, good.
Okay, good. No human pyramids, none of that stuff.
Right. Yeah. Open hand slapped, Pat.
Yeah.
I know that's horrifying.
I know. That's horrifying. I know.
I fire my weapon into the ground a couple of times to scare the guys on the inside to speaking. They started talking because they felt like we meant business. We got valuable intel out of them that my command never used.
Wait a minute. I just want to drop a marker here that the command never used. Got intel about the attempt on the base?
More so to the type of network they'd established and how the call downs were occurring, because these guys were hiding SIM cards on our base. I mean, you can't find a SIM card anywhere, right? But they were hiding SIM cards. And at the times that they were allowed access to phones, they would make calls out based on the info that they had.
And you got this information because of an open hand slap.
No.
Okay. and shooting outside into the ground.
Right. Not even, you know, in the vicinity of these guys. I walked away to a berm, fired into the ground. No one was in danger.
Amazing.
But the command brought charges of war crimes.
Well, yeah, you talk about fruit from a poisoned tree. That's an open hand slap. That's as poison as that tree can get.
Can I tell you something? All right. When I think of war crimes, I think Holocaust, open hand slap.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Charged with war crimes.
That's unbelievable.
By us.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
By us.
Psychological torture.
Jeez.
That was a justification given. Yeah.
Incredible.
So the helicopter that was coming in to pick these guys up, you go to your command and say, I have some information, and you know, we were running out of time.
Well, they wouldn't send birds. That's the thing. It's for almost 4 days during that 96 hours that I just mentioned. That was a part of these broken rules of engagement that were part of the Afghan theater. Keep in mind, in Afghanistan, we had put ourselves under NATO, which is a dangerous thing to do unto itself. In Iraq, you fall under the U.S. flag. In Afghanistan, you fall under NATO. So there's a whole set of rules of engagement the American public, I think, are unaware of. A great deal more constraints and restrictions. I'd been asking for two birds to come pick these 12 up, two Blackhawks. Six could have fit in each with a guard, and they would have been moved on their way, would have been a very minimal logistical requirement.
And if they weren't picked up, you had to release them?
Release them after 4 days. I'd had to do it 12 other times prior to this particular incident.
Jeez.
And this is common. This is what folks don't understand back home, is this is rampant. This is systemic. This is what things have gotten to over the last 8-10 years in our theaters of conflict. So I had asked for these birds to show up. They wouldn't send them. As soon as they caught wind of what I did, an investigation was launched, which led to a hearing and me being drummed out of the military along with a handful of my other guys. It's the day the investigation started, which was the day after I took these actions to interrogate, no joke, I think they sent maybe 6 or 8 Blackhawks in to drop off investigators on our base to investigate myself and the men. So they couldn't do it for the detainees.
Didn't have two for the detainees.
Right, but they had half a dozen or more to investigate us.
Unbelievable.
Let you digest that for a second. Back in a second.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BECK.
The true story of Dog Company, American soldiers abandoned by their command. You have command do an investigation. You find out you're in Afghanistan, that your company has 12 spies in it, including your interpreter. They know it. They're basically telling you, just release them back into the population. By not sending the Blackhawks, within a few hours, the time is up and you're going to have to just release them. You need information because there's a major bust coming down. You're investigated. You're told to get out of the army. You're discharged. They charge you with war crimes, which obviously doesn't go anywhere. How frightened were you of your own country?
I don't know that I was thinking that I was frightened of my country at the time. When they took me out of command and they moved me to another base in Afghanistan, basically put me in a form of isolation. I wasn't confined, but to a place where I didn't know anybody and really didn't allow for others to communicate with me, awaiting for the investigation to be completed. I think I put on about 20 pounds of muscle working out 2 and 3 times a day, worried about going to Leavenworth.
That's weird. That I put about 20 pounds on two of that was air quote muscle myself.
I've obviously lost it all at this point, but I was frightened, to say the least, but in the most instinctual and basic way for my own self-preservation, in disbelief of what had happened.
This has to be so disheartening when, you know, you volunteered to fight for your country and you were in the process of protecting it, and then this is how you get treated for it.
You say here on the cover, it says abandoned by their high command. They didn't abandon you. They betrayed you.
Yes.
They chose sides.
Yes, they did. Mm.
You weren't allowed to put abandoned on the cover, betrayed on the cover, were you?
We were asked to change it, yes. It was a little too strong for some folks in our legal department, but yeah.
And you know something about legal departments now, because
no kidding.
Trying to get the information to write this book,
yeah.
The rules didn't apply to the federal government, did it?
No. Wow. It was just, I think that's the part that scared me the most about my own government, right? Just the infringement upon the freedoms that we think we have or have had over the past however many decades, centuries, didn't seem to apply to me and my men once we had basically shown the government to be less than what they wanted to be shown as.
Is this a factor of the Obama administration, or is this, does it go a lot deeper than that? Is it still going on?
I think it's going to take a while to root out what's been done over a longer period than the Obama administration, but I think certainly over the past 8-10 years, things have gotten worse.
Yeah, I think this really started getting going maybe a couple of years into the, couple of years after 2001, when we started getting all politically correct. And it was dragging on and not going well. We started making all kinds of stupid, politically correct moves.
Well, I appreciate you taking us back to the beginning. I think that's where a lot of this
began. Hang on just a second. Yeah. I want to further that when we come back.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
We are on a very important weekend. We may meet here Monday and say, nothing happened. We might meet here Monday and the world could be a different place. The world could be at war. Russia just put troops on the North Korean border. Armaments. And China has just put troops on the North Korean border. China or Reuters is now backtracking. There was a story that said that China has just within the hour canceled flights to North Korea. China is responding saying, no, that's because there's not a lot of business to North Korea right now. So we're only just cutting back on flights. Okay. Several top Pentagon officials said, if we believe that North Korea is going to do this nuclear test this weekend, which they have promised to, that we will first strike. World could be a very, very different place. And we have a guy who you should know and a story that you should know. It is the story of Dog Company. Dog Company, just read the book. Roger Hill, he's the captain of Dog Company, and he is with us. He is telling us the truth that we all know. We have handcuffed our troops beyond all reason. There are spies among our troops, and we can't do anything about it. And how do we win a war? How do we win a war like that?
That's the question. I don't think we can. That's one of my biggest concerns, one of the biggest reasons we wrote this book.
Does it get any better under Trump, do you think?
I'm hopeful because I think he's surrounded himself with the right folks, at least from Mattis. A military perspective. I think everybody agrees that Mattis is the right guy.
Does Mattis have the power to move this? Can a guy come in and fix this quickly? You know, President Obama, and it started under Trump. I mean, you know, when you fire people like General Boykin, when you fire people like General Boykin for politically incorrect speech,
yeah,
and that started under Bush.
Yeah,
how fast can we turn this around?
It's going to take time. I mean, haven't we been at this degradation of our country and its values, our government, our military for a long time? It's going to take a while to shovel our way out of this.
You mentioned the trouble that an open hand slap of a enemy combatant caused. What do you think about enhanced interrogation techniques like waterboarding?
They're necessary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not doing any. It's just the illusion of.
I've never been waterboarded, but man, I've been through some hell. Ranger school, West Point. You know, I have buddies who've been through SEAL, other special operations training, SEER, which includes a lot of these techniques that you talk about.
Yeah, we do it to our own. I mean, some of the SEALs, we do it to our own.
Yeah.
Here's what to expect if you're captured. So we do it to our own, but we can't do it to an enemy combatant.
Well, part of the problem here is that we talk so much about the things that we do. So one of the best forms of defense is just showing that you're willing to act when it's time to act.
Well, that's why you going in the back and shooting your gun, that's what made them talk. They thought these guys are rogue.
Yeah.
These guys will do it.
So on a national scale, if we're strong when we need to be strong, we set a precedence of deterrence.
That's why we dropped the Moab yesterday.
It is. Yeah.
That was not a message to Afghanistan. That was a message perhaps to the whole world, but definitely to North Korea.
Yeah.
You and I have some friends in common. And we have some things in common. I have never been more afraid for myself and my family and my country than when I was involved in some litigation recently. And we're going to be doing I settled that because the plaintiff would settle without non-disclosure. And it was another $1.5 million to fight it. Or I could settle with no non-disclosure so all of the records could be opened.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be, it's taking us a while because we want to be legally very careful.
Yeah.
But when that case is opened, you will see the government bending over backwards to protect who I believe is just protect a side I don't believe in.
Yeah,
let's put it that way. And doing everything against the law to throw it at an American citizen. And when, you know, I was in a room with defense attorneys and I said, they have this information.
Yeah.
They know we have this information. They have given us a paper that has been redacted that is exactly the same group of papers, but they will not verify. They'll stand in contempt. They'll say, we don't care what this judge orders us. We are not producing that. How does an American citizen defend himself against the government?
Yeah.
And it is truly terrifying because there is nobody you can run to.
I understand. Yeah.
I know you understand. I know you understand.
And I, you know, not that I can relate to the amount of money, but you know, we lost our life savings because I think, to your point, even the defense that the government wanted to assign me wore the same unit patch as the command that was trying to prosecute me. Mm. So there's just all this inherent and, you know, wired in conflict of interest. You know, these people are rating these people who represent you on their performance evaluations. So we had to find outside help to represent us. It cost us everything. The government doesn't play by the rules that it forces everyone else to play
by. It doesn't play by the Constitution.
Yeah.
And when it stops playing by the Constitution, I've been ringing the bell on this, but nobody really wants to look into it.
Yeah.
And you're doing the same thing. If people don't wake up to this soon, you do, in some ways, if you really step out of line, you already have an authoritarian regime.
Yeah.
This government can and will destroy you if you step out of line. Yeah. And they've tried with you.
This story, Dog Company, is difficult. It's tough, but it's only demonstrating a symptom of an overall problem.
Tell me what they did when you wrote this book. Tell me what they did to cover the tracks.
So central to the book is a set of findings that came out of a hearing. It's a military equivalent to a civilian grand jury. There's an investigating officer that serves as the equivalent to a judge. Mm-hmm. He hears all the evidence. We had a 3-day, almost 4-day hearing. He puts together a set of findings. And in this case, it was 90-something pages to include witness testimony. And when the hearing is over, I think everyone realized that the government had a knee-jerk reaction to our case. They were trying to set an example. Keep in mind that because of the tone that was set with the last administration, people were celebrating things like throwing soldiers under the bus. Oh, you slapped some detainees, or are you psychologically tortured such and such? Well, let's make an example of you because, you know, that's contrary to what we believe should be the right thing to do. And so those things were celebrated during this administration. And so there were commanders that were vying to raise their hand and say, hey, I'm fighting the good fight for political correctness. And so let's get me an award. Let's get me accolades for having, you know, spotted this traitor, Captain Hill, for doing his job, right? So this Article 32 findings, the government, the command at this time, found a way to make it an incomplete record so that it would not be made available or could not be made available through the Freedom of Information Act. We were able to get it because of a brave gentleman who was working on the government side of the case, provided it to us some years later. So the findings, a lot of the detail around the case are in this book, but that command as an extension of the government went out of their way to basically shield it from FOIA.
How do you win a war in this environment?
We're not winning wars in this environment.
How do we?
So you can't.
How much longer are we going to have somebody who's in a position that you were in as a captain that will say, screw it, it's my troops? How much longer, how many more lessons do they have to teach, and how much more do they have to degrade the kind of man that we have leading us as as groups, because they're asking you to choose between battles of engagement and your men.
They are. Yeah.
How much longer is that going to go before we got nothing, literally nothing?
Yeah, you guys get this. Enough of this goes around. Parents will stop allowing their sons and daughters to sign up. It's not worth it. And it's going to hurt our overall military readiness, because we need people who believe in what this country's about, who love our principles and values, to sign up and serve.
That's I want you to talk to my nephew. He just came in from out of town. He's already served once. Mm. And he said last night, I'm thinking about signing up again. I said, don't you dare do it.
Yeah.
Don't do it. And he said, why? And I said, it's not worth it.
Well, now you've got a book to hand him.
Yeah, I will hand it to him.
Got a good case study.
Because it's not the military that we used to be. It's not the military we need to be. And
the other thing the government did, they have an approval process through the Office of Security Review. They review manuscripts, articles, books, such as mine. They advertise that they can turn them around in a month. It took them a year to get it back to us. It was peppered. I mean, if you'll flip through it, it's peppered with redactions, right? 90% of those redactions are of content that you can find on federally funded websites. Not hard documents, not sensitive information, but like you can go on the internet right now and find 90% of the stuff in the context that's provided in the book on their own websites. 2/3 of the redactions are centered around this ideal of catch and release or revolving door detention policies in Afghanistan. So they had nothing to do with sensitive military information. They just didn't. They wanted to cover their own asses when it came to how they're letting our troops be killed by these insider threats, because they're so mismanaging the enemies that were taken off the battlefield.
What does this mean? Who's doing the vetting? And what does this mean to, you know, we've got 100,000 people that Obama let in because he vetted them, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And I've been saying for a long time, you can't vet. You don't. I mean, there's no way to tell. We won't even admit that there's a problem within Islam.
Yeah.
How can we possibly vet?
I had 2 translators in Iraq. I fought with the Kurds and the Peshmerga in northern Iraq, just south of Mosul. We took a group of Iraqi motorized infantry down to Ramadi in 2006. That's a whole other story of failure on the military's account I'd love to get into. But those 2 translators and I became very close friends. I helped them apply for special immigration status. They're in the U.S., vibrant citizens, devout Sunni Muslims, love America. They are submissive to our values and principles.
Mm-hmm.
Their neighbors and them get along great, right? Because of their understanding of what they have to do to get along in this country.
Yeah.
In Afghanistan, my interpreter, his name is Sammy in the book. We're not using his real name for legal reasons. The guy that ultimately betrayed me the most, if you will, betrayed my men the most, we were up in the process of applying for his immigration status.
Oh my God.
Oh wow.
To come to the U.S. I had offered him, through permission of my family, to come live with me once he got stateside.
Oh my gosh.
So when we get into this debate about you know, how and if and can we vet people well, no, the system's broken. And even myself, admittedly, you know,
you were broken. You were duped.
Yeah, I was. But I also had expected that the background checks and the security checks that were done at a higher level were thorough and complete. Mm-hmm. So I had this going in assumption, right?
Right.
But
jeez, this is a General Boykin says, a powerful story of brotherhood and heroism, both on and off the battlefield. This is the story of Dog Company. This is a story that everyone should read, especially if you love a good war story, you love intrigue, but also if you love our nation, it's important that you read it because it needs to be fixed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
We're just talking in the break, and we're going to continue our conversation on Facebook Live here in just a few minutes, because we were talking to the captain about a story that has been covered up. It's an unbelievable story, kind of makes Benghazi look like a walk in the park. We'll continue. Pat's going to go into Facebook Live in our studio. It takes about 5 minutes. So just go to facebook.com/Glenn Beck and we'll continue our conversation here in a minute. Happy, happy Easter. The Lord has risen. There is hope.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.